The following message is brought to you by Terry Moore. And now, Mr. Moore.
Let's go ahead and open up to the book of Jude once again. The book of Jude to begin the message today. Last week I had given a sermon regarding a warning from the elder Jude. And he had explained that there were some issues in the Church of God that they were facing at that time. And he wrote about people that believed in God, people that were mingling among brethren. They were attending church services and their church activities. And these individuals thought very highly of themselves. And at the same time, they were discounting the teaching of true ministers in the Church of God. And in this way, they were portraying themselves as being teachers of Christ and misleading people in a variety of ways. Now, we saw how that reflects activity that is happening throughout the Church of God in some areas and among some people today. Now, Jude had made a comparison between those individuals and three individuals in the Bible from history. He had said that they have went in the way of Cain, and we reviewed, therefore, what we know about Abel's brother, Cain, and we saw how that Cain was not entirely evil or wicked, as some have thought, that he was an individual who did accept God's existence, and he did honor God to a degree, and of course there's the problem, to a degree, so we see that Cain was not fully committed to God. And Jude also spoke of another individual that was compared to these men and some women who crept into the church unaware. And he said this in Jude 11. He said, "Woe to them, for they have gone in the way of Cain, have run greedily in the error of Balaam for profit." And that is going to be the focus today. You know, what is this comparison now between these people and what Balaam did that deserves a woe? Because Jude says, woe to them. Is there anything that perhaps we should consider that so that we don't make the same type of error? And this is going to be our focus today. So I want to go back and I'm going to review the chapters discussing Balaam in Numbers 22. If you'd go back to the book of Numbers in chapter 22 to begin. The first thing that I would like us to understand before we begin reading about Balaam is that the term that is translated as error in Jude 11, this error of Balaam, does not have the same definition as the English word error. Now, when we think of an error, what do you think of? A mistake. Yeah, you think of a mistake. And it's actually defined as an act, assertion, or belief that unintentionally deviates from what is correct, right, or true. Unintentional. I made a mistake, an error. But the term that is used to describe what Balaam did doesn't indicate that it was unintentional at all. It actually is defined as something that is intentional. It means fraudulence. It means straying from orthodoxy or piety. It means deceit or to deceive, the act or process of, therefore, deluding. So this means that God's inspired view of what Balaam did was not because he made a mistake. His error was intentional. But did it start out that way? That's a good question. So before we begin reading Numbers 22, let's give a little context of what's happening in the history of Israel. They had come out of Egypt. And they had experienced a great many things. They had long, this is the event we're going to pick up here, is long after they had been given the Ten Commandments at Mount Sinai. And they had been on the move in the wilderness for many years, likely two, maybe three decades. And they were having great success, that is, in defeating those people who would come up against them in the wilderness. And of course, the credit goes to God, who was giving them strength and also causing those people in the area that were hostile toward Israel to be afraid of them. So Israel had not set out to wage war at this time. The conquests had not yet begun, but they still were perceived as a threat to those people in the area, wherever they went. And obviously, if you consider the number of people, we're talking like close to 2 million people or so, and all of their camps and flocks and herds and what have you, people would be very concerned about that number of people that would not be considered native to the land moving around in the territory. So the hullabaloo did not go unnoticed by the surrounding communities, the surrounding tribes who heard of the victories of Israel. And most natives were very concerned about this. And so in Numbers 22, in verse 1, then the children of Israel moved and camped in the plains of Moab on the side of the Jordan across from Jericho. And now Balak, the son of Zippor, saw all that Israel had done to the Amorites. And Moab was exceedingly afraid, the people of Moab exceedingly afraid of the people because they were many. And Moab was sick with dread because of the children of Israel. And so this is anxiety to the point to where they were like, you know, trembling at times, feeling very upset about this. And of course, I think this is a fulfillment of Exodus 15:15, the song of Moses, after they had went across the Red Sea, where it was said that trembling will take hold of the enemies of Israel. And so as we continue in verse 4, so Moab said to the elders of Midian, now this company will lick up everything around us as an ox licks up the grass of the field. And Balak, the son of Zippor, was king of the Moabites at that time. And he sent messengers to Balaam, the son of Beor, at Pethor, which is near the river in the land of the sons of his people, to call him, saying, look, a people has come from Egypt. See, they cover the face of the earth and are settling next to me. And therefore, please come at once and curse this people for me, for they are too mighty for me. Perhaps I shall be able to defeat them and drive them out of the land. For I know that he whom you bless is blessed, and he whom you curse is cursed. So he reaches out to this religious individual. He was well known in the land, Balaam, and the Moabites believed he was able to influence situations supernaturally. Now, whether or not he actually could influence situations supernaturally is not known. It's assumed because of what these what the history says here, but we don't know for certain. In fact, we don't know much about Balaam's history prior to this event. But as we continue, we are going to see that this man, Balaam, was in fact familiar with the true God, with the God of Israel, and apparently he did recognize him as God, and he had a degree of respect for this God of Israel. Now, whether or not also Balaam also revered the devil or some other gods is not entirely known, but certainly it appears that the respect he had for the God of Israel was not equal to those other gods, that he held the God of Israel to be superior. The Bible story books, and I read through them in studying this message, I read through the section regarding Balaam, and these are the Bible story books that were produced by Worldwide Church of God under the leadership of Mr. Armstrong, and they portray Balaam as being very wicked from the very beginning. But in my study, it seems like that is unclear. Now, obviously, he was not an entirely honest individual, as we will see. And there was a degree of malice, I think, in his mind. But I don't know, I wouldn't say that he was just entirely wicked from the very start. And we'll see that as we continue. In verse 7, so the elders of Moab and the elders of Midian, here we have Balak calling for Balaam to come down and curse Israel. And then he sent elders of Midian, and they departed with a diviner's fee in their hand, and they came to Balaam and spoke to him the words of Balak. And he said to them, that is, Balaam said to these people after they spoke to him, lodge here tonight, and I will bring back word to you as the Eternal speaks to me. And so the princes of Moab stayed with Balaam. And then God came to Balaam and said, who are these men that are with you? Now, obviously, God knew who these men were. I think this was God testing his honesty. And so Balaam said to God, Balak, the son of Zippor, king of Moab, has sent to me, saying, look, a people has come out of Egypt, and they cover the face of the earth. Come now, curse them for me. Perhaps I shall be able to overpower them and drive them out. And God said to Balaam, you shall not go with them. You shall not curse the people, for they are blessed. And so Balaam rose in the morning and said to the princes of Balak, go back to your land, for the Eternal has refused to give me permission to go with you. And the princes of Moab rose and went to Balak and said, Balaam refuses to come with us. And then Balak again sent princes more numerous and more honorable than they. And they came to Balaam and said to him, thus says Balak, the son of Zippor, please let nothing hinder you from coming to me, for I will certainly honor you greatly, and I will do whatever you say to me. Therefore, please come, curse this people for me. And so this was obviously the first time was a huge disappointment for the princes of Moab and also for Balak. And it, you know, they would very much liked for Balaam to come down and curse Israel. But Balaam said, I can't do that. The God of Israel spoke to me and said, no, you can't do it. And I'm not going to go against his instructions. Now, obviously, we're going to see Balaam, I think, was very disappointed about this as well. That he would have very, very much liked to receive the diviner's reward. It likely consisted of gold and silver. And, of course, there would be a level of honor and prestige. And now we have the second entourage coming up saying that I'll do whatever you say to me. He's not going to make him king of Moab, but, man, he's got like an open door to Balak's kingdom here. And so Balaam answered the second entourage and said to the servants of Balak, and this is verse 18 now, though Balak were to give me his house full of silver and gold, I could not go beyond the word of the Eternal my God to do less or more. So, hey, you can offer me the entire kingdom, but I can't go against what God said. And now, therefore, please, you also stay here tonight that I may know what more the Lord will say to me. So here we have Balaam saying, I'm not going to go against God. I can't do that. But you see that that reward is still in his mind. He's like, but why don't you stay here and maybe things will change? I think he was hoping things would change. And so that night, it's in verse 20, it continues to say that God came to Balaam at night and said to him, if the men come to call you, rise and go with them. But only the word which I speak to you, that you shall do. And so Balaam rose in the morning, saddled his donkey, and went with the princes of Moab. Now, these last two verses that I read here need a little bit of explanation, because a simple read appears that Balaam did nothing wrong by getting up in the morning, saddling his donkey, getting a couple of servants, and going out to meet the men. However, when we see the terminology that is used here, and we're going to read the next verse where God was upset about him leaving and going with these people, we see that God said, if the men come to call you, rise and go with them. He wasn't talking about the first time that the princes came. He wasn't talking about the second entourage. He's saying, if they come to call you now, again, rise and go with them. But Balaam didn't wait for this, did he? He didn't wait for them to come call him in the morning. In fact, the princes the evening prior thought, it's a done deal. He already said, I can't go. You can give me all the silver and gold that Balak has, and I'm not going to go against what God has told me. And so they would have been on their way the next day. So Balaam, he didn't wait for a third beckoning from these people. He reasoned, I think, that the first two summons, that's enough. They came. They called me twice. So it appears he was even excited about this. He got up in the morning, he saddled his donkey, he got a few servants ready to go, and he hit the road. Probably thinking about the gold, the silver, the prestige and honor. And it appears here that he went to catch up to the entourage. This entourage must have already left, and we're going to see that as we continue. Now, some people might interpret the situation differently, but how I'm explaining it, this is the way I see it. This is the way Herbert Armstrong saw it. This is the way it was portrayed by Basil Warburton in those books that were produced by Worldwide Church of God. And in fact, this is the way that many other biblical scholars view it as well. Now, something else to consider is that the night previously, Balaam told the dignitaries of Moab that he wasn't going to deviate. I can't deviate from what God said. But stay here, and hopefully things will change. And this would have been, I think, a clear message that it was the same message that was given the first group that visited. And yet he wanted them to stay because he wanted the reward. He wanted something to change. Now, Balaam, as we continue, he traveled some distance only with a donkey and two servants, indicating that the princes must have already left and that he was trying to catch up with the entourage. And so by not waiting for a third invitation to go with these men, Balaam's desire, therefore, the conclusion I have is that Balaam's desire must have been, I really would like to curse Israel so that I can get the reward, so that I can get the prestige, the honor. But he was not, he'd set his mind, I'm not going to boldly go against the instructions of the eternal, it says, the eternal my God. So as we continue in verse 22 here, it says, then God's anger was aroused because he went, and the angel of the Eternal took his stand in the way as an adversary against him. And Balaam was riding on his donkey, and his two servants were with him. And the donkey saw the angel of the Eternal standing in the way with his drawn sword in his hand, and the donkey turned aside out of the way and went into the field. So the donkey's like, danger, danger, no, don't go that way. And so Balaam was upset about this, though. He struck the donkey to turn her back on to the road. And then the angels of the Eternal stood in a narrow path between the vineyards, with a wall on this side and a wall on that side. And when the donkey saw that the angel of the Eternal saw the angel of the Eternal, she pushed herself against the wall and crushed Balaam's foot against the wall. And so he struck her again. And then the angel of the Eternal went further and stood in a narrow place where there was no way to turn either to the right hand or to the left. And when the donkey saw the angel of the Eternal, she lay down under Balaam and just didn't move. So Balaam's anger was aroused and he struck the donkey with his staff, really upset about this deviation from the path that he wanted to travel. And then at this point, something amazing happened. It says that the Eternal opened the mouth of the donkey, and she said to Balaam, what have I done to you that you have struck me these three times? And Balaam answered the donkey, saying, because you have abused me, and I wish there were a sword in my hand, for now I would kill you. And so the donkey said to Balaam, am I not your donkey on which you have ridden ever since I became yours to this day? In other words, haven't I been faithful to you all this time? Was I ever disposed to do this to you? And Balaam said, no. No, you haven't treated me like this. So I think this was instilling a bit of a feeling of guilt in Balaam. Now, this is an amazing part of the story. And of course, this is where many people get tripped up. Many people find this very hard to believe. And of course, the difficulty surrounds what? A talking donkey. You know, people might have images of the old Mr. Ed, the 1950s television show, talking Mr. Ed, the horse that talked, and he had little strings attached to his upper mouth here, and they'd kind of pull on him, and it'd look like he was talking. So there would be somebody there with a microphone talking for the horse. And it was kind of silly, kind of humorous. But that's not what was going on here. There were no strings attached to this donkey. It actually did speak. Now, whether or not it was God interpreting what this animal was thinking, or if I think this was God putting words into the animal's mouth, but people question it. So the question we ask ourselves, did it out really speak? Did this animal really speak? And if so, why did God choose to perform this miracle? Because it does seem quite odd, doesn't it? Seems like an odd miracle. Well, to begin, God told Balaam only to go if the princess came to call him. And he wasn't talking about the first entourage. He wasn't talking about the second time that they arrived. He was talking about if they come to ask you to go again. And so it appears, therefore, God leaned toward anyway, desiring for Balaam not to go. But he wasn't sold on the idea. And so God was not going to prevent it. He could have easily stopped Balaam from going at all, but he didn't. Not entirely. He was just trying to push him in one direction, saying, are you going to go in the direction that I'm leading you? And Balaam was refusing. So Balaam was riding on this donkey, and obviously it appears that he had this donkey for some time. He knew the animal. He knew that the animal had served him very well for many years. And the angel standing in the way caused the animal to go off path, to go in a different direction. And this, I think, was in part a sign that God was that God didn't desire for Balaam to go that way. I don't want you to do this. I'm not going to put up a brick wall so you can't, but I'm trying to push you in one direction. Now, despite the angel getting in the way of the donkey three times, Balaam was upset about this deviation, very upset to the point where his frustration, he was letting it out on the donkey here. But this donkey was actually trying to protect him. You know, he saw what Balaam did not see initially. And danger, danger, that's, we go that way, we're going to die. And so what this represents, therefore, I believe, is that Balaam was determined to do what he wanted to do, despite the fact that God was saying, I would rather you do this. And God was giving him an opportunity. Are you going to do what I would like you to do? Are you going to choose your own way? Because if you choose your own way, there's danger there. And it's a lesson for us. There is a lesson in this story for us. You see, could it be that God sometimes presents us with circumstances, with situations that he is attempting to move us in one direction, but we push against it? We keep pushing forward. Do we get upset? Do we get angry when things don't go the way we would like them to go? Not considering the fact that maybe this is something God prefers that we did not do. Now, this happened to Balaam three times. Every time he pushed back. And the number then turns to four as we continue. And these numbers, they might be prophetic. And I'm going to discuss that a bit later. And so the donkey spoke to Balaam, and Balaam responded, and I'm sure the mood was tense. I mean, this kind of just spells out, here's what happened, and here's what happened, and here's what happened. But I think Balaam was likely shocked at what had happened, that his donkey speaking to him. But just, what do you say? You respond, well, and of course, what do? We try to excuse ourselves. Well, you're trying to hurt me, so I'm pushing back. Now we see that the angel of the Eternal reveals himself to Balaam in the next verses here, verse 31. Then the Eternal opened Balaam's eyes, and he saw the angel of the Eternal standing in the way, and with his drawn sword in his hand, and he bowed his head and fell flat on his face. So Balaam obviously was amazed at what he'd seen. He recognized that this has got to be an angel of God. And he fell down, probably in reverence, and maybe in worship. Who was this angel? I think this was Christ, because the angel did not say, stand up, don't worship me. Instead, the angel of the Eternal said to him, in verse 32, why have you struck your donkey these three times? Behold, I have come out to stand against you, because your way is perverse before me. And so his direction was going in the direction that God did not desire, wasn't going to stop it, but he didn't want you to go that way. But also, could he be talking about your way of thinking is perverse before me. So I've come out to stand against you. And then he goes on to say, this angel goes on to say, the donkey saw me and turned aside from me these three times. If she had not turned aside from me, surely I would have killed you by now and let her live. And Balaam said to the angel of the Eternal, I have sinned, for I did not know you stood in the way against me. Now, therefore, if it displeases you, I will turn back. And so, again, I think this was a test that God was giving Balaam, because the angel of the Eternal replied to Balaam, go with the men, but only the word that I speak to you, that you shall speak. And so Balaam went with the princes of Balak. And so it appears that God was going to give Balaam further opportunities to prove himself. He was already heading in the wrong direction physically and perhaps spiritually, but would that same path continue to be traveled? Would he have a change of heart toward the God of Israel? Well, like all of us, Balaam had a choice in this matter. You know, God does not force anybody to choose his way of life. He allows circumstances, he orchestrates situations at times, and he gives us the opportunity to choose what we are going to do. It's the same situation that Adam and Eve faced so long ago, and it's continuously repeated throughout the scriptures and continuously is happening unto this day, that we have two choices. What are we going to do? The two trees. Numbers 22, and continuing in verse 36 this time. Now when Balak heard that Balaam was coming, he went out to meet him at the city of Moab, which is on the border at the Arnon, the boundary of the territory. Then Balak said to Balaam, did I not earnestly send to you, calling for you? Why did you not come to me? Am I not able to honor you? And Balaam said to Balak, look, I have come to you now. Have I any power at all to say anything? The word that God puts in my mouth, that I must speak. So he was again giving this little forewarning here. Look, I'm here now, but it doesn't mean that I'm going to curse Israel. I'm going to repeat the words that God says to me. And so this seems to start off well in the conversation anyway, but how is this going to turn out? Let's continue. So Balaam went with Balak, and they came to Kirjath Huzoth. And Balak offered oxen and sheep, and he sent some to Balaam and to the princes who were with him. And so it was the next day that Balak took Balaam and brought him to the high places of Baal, that from there he might observe the extent of the people. And so he's taking him up to a high place, would have been a mountainous area. And apparently it's related to the worship of Baal or Baal. And this would have been an area where he could see the camps of Israel. In chapter 23 and verse 1, then Balaam said to Balak, build seven altars for me here and prepare for me seven bulls and seven rams. And Balak did just as Balaam had spoken, and Balak and Balaam offered a bull and a ram on each altar. Now, it might appear that this is like inspired or something. Seven altars, the number seven. It's a biblical number representing completion. I don't think that God inspired Balaam to give these instructions to make seven altars and to offer seven offerings of two different animals on each one. Then Balaam said to Balak, after this was done, stand by your burnt offering, and I will go. Perhaps the Eternal will come to meet me, and whatever he shows me, I will tell you. And so he went to a desolate height. And God met Balaam, and he said to him, I have prepared seven altars, and I have offered on each altar a bull and a ram. And then the Eternal put a word in Balaam's mouth and said, return to Balak, and thus you shall speak. And so the words that we are going to hear next is what God told Balaam to say to Balak. So he returned, and there he was, standing by his burnt offering, he and all the princes of Moab. And he took up his oracle, which is basically a term meaning like a discourse or a proverb, and said, Balak, the king of Moab, has brought me from Aram, from the mountains of the east. Come curse Jacob for me, and come denounce Israel. How shall I curse whom God has not cursed? And how shall I denounce whom the Eternal has not denounced? From the top of the rocks I see him, speaking of Israel, the people of Jacob. And from the hills I behold him. There, a people dwelling alone, not reckoning itself among the nations. In other words, not thinking there's something great or something wonderful. Who can count the dust of Jacob? Or number one-fourth of Israel? Let me die the death of the righteous, and let my end be like his. And so if I could be like Israel, that's good. If God looks at me like he does the people of Israel, I'll be happy with that. I'll be satisfied with that. And so these are very positive words about the people of Israel. Obviously not a curse, as Balak had hoped. Some of these words are actually prophetic about the people of Israel. It refers to them like grains of dust, and that's very similar to what God told Jacob in Genesis 32 and verse 12, where he told Jacob that he would make his descendants as the sand of the sea, which cannot be numbered for multitude. Very similar. Something good to have in your side notes here, I think, with this scripture. And so God was speaking to the princes of Moab here through Balaam. And these words greatly displeased the king. Obviously, he was looking for a curse. He wanted to be able to destroy the people of Israel. And instead, what does he get? A blessing. Numbers 23 and verse 11. Then Balak said to Balaam, what have you done to me? I took you to curse my enemies. And look, you have blessed them bountifully. And so he answered and said, must I not take heed to speak what the Eternal has put in my mouth? And then Balak said to him, please come with me to another place from which you may see them, and you shall see only the outer part of them, and shall not see them all, and curse them for me from there. So he's hoping that if he goes, takes them to another place where he doesn't see all the people, maybe just sees a little bit of them, he's not going to have such a positive thought in his mind about Israel. Perhaps, you know, the geographical location will cause you to think something else about these people. And so Balak brought Balaam to the field of Zophim, the top of Pisgah, and built seven altars and offered a bull and a ram on each altar. And again, as we're going through this, we see all these descriptions of places, you know, the field of Zophim at the top of Pisgah and Peor and in the field of so-and-so. And I think this is just further proof that the Bible is a historical document. If somebody was just telling a story, there would be no reason to give these details about these names of this place over there or by that mountain. It doesn't serve any other purpose except for to show you, look, here is where these events took place. And people that were aware of those locations would say, ah, I know where that's at. There may even still be some evidence of those seven altars still there. Or at least there would have been for some time. And so let's continue in verse 15. Balaam said to Balak, now stand here by your burnt offering while I meet the Eternal over there. And then the Eternal met Balaam and put a word in his mouth and said, go back to Balak, and thus you shall speak. And so he came to him, and there he was standing by his burnt offering, and the princes of Moab were with him. And Balak said to him, what has the Eternal spoken? And then he took up his oracle, his adage, his discourse, and said, rise up, Balak, and hear. Listen to me, son of Zippor. God is not a man that he should lie, nor a son of man that he should repent. Has he said, and will he not do? Or has he spoken, and he will not make it good? Behold, I have received a command to bless, and he has blessed, and I cannot reverse it, is what Balaam is saying here. He has not observed iniquity in Jacob, at least not at this time. We know that he did observe iniquity among the people of Israel at one time, but they were apparently on the right track right here, and God had a plan for them. Nor has he seen wickedness in Israel. So it's not the kind of evil that would warrant a curse against the people of Israel. And then the Eternal, his God, is with him, and the shout of a king is among them. God brings them out of Egypt. He has the strength like a wild ox. And for there is no sorcery against Jacob, nor any divination against Israel. It now must be said of Jacob and of Israel, oh, what God has done. Look, a people rises like a lioness and lifts itself up like a lion, and it shall not lie down until it devours the prey and drinks the blood of the slain. So this is figurative speech talking about, you know, Israel was going to absorb the livelihood. Life is in the blood, but Israel would move into the land, drive the people out, and absorb the livelihood of the pagan communities. So again, acclamation, blessing of Israel, not what Balak was hoping for. So it seems that Balaam was doing the right thing, at least in part. And I think that's what we're going to, where it is. In part, he was partly doing the right thing by repeating God's words as they were told to him. In verse 25, then Balak said to Balaam, neither curse them at all, nor bless them at all. In other words, don't say anything. If you can't say what I want you to say, don't say anything. Just keep quiet about it. So Balaam answered and said to Balak, did I not tell you, saying all that the Eternal speaks, that I must do? And so again, seeing that this location did not yield the results that Balak would have liked to have heard, he thought to try someplace else. And in all of this, something we have to consider, that in all of this, Balaam could have refused. He could have refused to go in the first place. He could have refused to participate in any of this. You know, I've told you, God isn't going to change his mind. You know, why are we doing this over and over again? I'm not going to do this anymore. He could have stopped, but he did not. Balaam did not stop in his attempts to change the situation. And it's because I believe Balaam had hoped that the situation would change, that he could curse Israel, that he would be able to receive this reward. And of course, this leads to the description of greed by Jude. Run greedily in the error of Balaam. He wanted the reward. He wanted the prestige. He wanted the honor. But yet, he still was not going to boldly go against the word of God here. And so let's continue in Numbers 23, in verse 27, where it says, then Balak said to Balaam, please come and I will take you to another place. Let's go try this again someplace else. Perhaps it will please God that you may curse them there, for me from there. So Balak took Balaam to the top of Peor that overlooks the wasteland. And then Balaam said to Balak, build for me here 7 altars and prepare for me 7 bulls and 7 rams. And Balak did as Balaam had said. Where am I? Oh, I lost my place. Yeah, that's right. And he offered a bull and a ram on every altar. Now when Balaam saw that it pleased the Eternal to bless Israel, he did not go, as at the other times, to seek to use sorcery, but he set his face toward the wilderness. And Balaam raised his eyes and saw Israel encamped according to their tribes, and the Spirit of God came upon him. And then he took up his oracle and said, the utterance of Balaam, the son of Beor, the utterance of the man whose eyes are opened, the utterance of him who hears the words of God, who sees the vision of the Almighty, who falls down with eyes wide open. How lovely are your tents, O Jacob, your dwellings, O Israel, like valleys that stretch out, like gardens by the riverside, like aloes planted by the Eternal, like cedars besides the waters. He shall pour water from his buckets, and his seed shall be in many waters. Again, prophecy. His king shall be higher than Agag, and his kingdom shall be exalted. God brings him out of Egypt, and he has strength like a wild ox. He shall consume the nations, his enemies. He shall break their bones and pierce them with arrows. He bows down, he lies down as a lion, and as a lion, who shall rouse him? Blessed is he who blesses you, and cursed is he who curses you. So here we have three attempts to provoke a curse, and all Balak got was blessing after blessing after blessing. And the frustration reaches a boiling point, you might say, but the king dared not hurt Balaam. In verse 10, then Balak's anger was aroused against Balaam, and he struck his hands together, being upset. And Balak said to Balaam, I called you to curse my enemies, and look, you have bountifully blessed them these three times. And now, therefore, flee to your place. Not saying it's you can leave now. He's saying, you better get out of here now. Flee. I'm really mad about this. Flee to your place. I said I would greatly honor you, but in fact, the Eternal has kept you back from honor. You're getting nothing out of this. So Balaam said to Balak, did I not also speak to your messengers whom you sent to me, saying, if Balak were to give me his house full of silver or gold, I could not go beyond the word of the Eternal to do good or bad of my own will? What the Eternal says, that I must speak. And now, indeed, I am going. I'm going to my people. Come, I will advise you what this people will do to your people in the latter days. And so this gets even more interesting now, because Balaam is offering a fourth prophecy, a final prophecy to Balak, and all of this would come true. In verse 15, so he took up his oracle and he said, the utterance of Balaam, the son of Beor, and the utterance of the man whose eyes are opened, the utterance of him who hears the words of God and has the knowledge of the Most High, who sees the vision of the Almighty, who falls down with eyes wide open. I see him, but not now. I behold him, but not near. A star shall come out of Jacob, a scepter shall rise out of Israel, and batter the brow of Moab and destroy all the sons of tumult. So this is a prophecy of Christ. And Edom shall be a possession. Seir also, his enemy, shall be a possession. While Israel does valiantly, out of Jacob one shall have dominion and destroy the remains of the city. So speaking about those who are evil. And then Balaam looked on Amalek, and he took up his oracle and said, Amalek was first among the nations, but shall be last until he perishes. So Amalek was a descendant of Esau and became a great people in this area. And then he looked on the Kenites, and he took up his oracle and said, firm is your dwelling place, and your nest is set in the rock. Nevertheless, Cain shall be burned. How long until Asher carries you away captive? And then he took up his oracle and said, alas, who shall live when God does this? But ships shall come from the coasts of Cyprus, and they shall afflict Asher and afflict Eber, and so shall Amalek until he perishes. And so Balaam rose and departed and returned to his place, and Balak also went his way. This is the last that we hear of Balaam in this account of history until his death sometime later. However, sometime after this, other things happened, and there is an indication of this as we're going to read a few New Testament scriptures. But we do see in Numbers 31 and verse 8 that Moses was told by God that to send Israel against Midianites. And when Israel went against the people of Midian, it says that they killed the kings of Midian and also Balaam. And so this, along with a few other verses we're going to read shortly, indicate that Balaam did not have a good heart, that God used him in this way. And it seems like he wanted to be obedient to God, but only in part, only on his own terms. He actually wanted to curse Israel. that was his intent, and that is why he continued to inquire of God about this. In Deuteronomy 23, a good scripture to have in your side notes here, Deuteronomy 23 and verse 5, it says, "Nevertheless, the Eternal your God would not listen to Balaam, but the Eternal your God turned the curse into a blessing for you." So in other words, it appears that Balaam was going to God saying, "I want to do this. Can we do this?" And he's like, "Nope. You're going to bless Israel. That's what you're going to receive." So this man hoped that something would change, but it didn't change. And even though Balaam did not openly, boldly proclaim a curse against the people of Israel, he did something after this, which is just about as bad. He tried to circumvent God's blessing. He tried to turn God's blessing into a curse for the people of Israel, and he did it for his own benefit, for his own profit. And this is evident if we read what happened next, what happened after this, at least, at some point after this, and it probably was not long. In verse 1 of chapter 25, it says, "Now Israel remained in Acacia Grove, and the people began to commit harlotry with the women of Moab." Coincidence? I think not. "They invited the people to the sacrifices of their gods, and the people ate, and they bowed down to their gods. And so Israel was joined to Baal of Peor, and the anger of the Eternal was aroused against Israel. And then the Eternal said to Moses, 'Take all the leaders of the people and hang the offenders before the Eternal out in the sun, that the fierce anger of the Eternal may turn away from Israel.'" In other words, this is abhorrent what you guys are doing. Perhaps some women as well. I say guys, but I mean what you people are doing. "And therefore, you're going to look on something that's abhorrent. Those offenders are going to be hung from a stake so that the people can see what I think about such activity. So Moses said to the judges of Israel, 'Every one of you kill his men who were joined to Baal of Peor.' And indeed, one of the children of Israel came and presented to his brethren a Midianite woman in the sight of Moses and in the sight of all the congregation of the children of Israel who were weeping at the door of the tabernacle of meeting because many people were getting killed. And now when Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, the son of Aaron, the priest, saw it, he rose from among the congregation, he took a javelin in his hand, and he went after the man of Israel into the tent, who was committing harlotry with this woman, and thrust both of them through, the man of Israel and the woman, through her body. And so the plague," there was apparently a plague, a curse from God at this time, "was stopped among the children of Israel. And those who died in the plague were 24,000. And then the Eternal spoke to Moses, saying, 'Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, the son of Aaron, the priest, has turned back my wrath from the children of Israel, because he was zealous with my zeal among them, and so that I did not consume the children of Israel in my zeal. And therefore say, Behold, I give to him my covenant of peace, and it shall be to him and his descendants after him, a covenant of an everlasting priesthood, because he was zealous for his God and made atonement for the children of Israel.' Now the name of the Israelite who was killed with the Midianite woman was Zimri, the son of Salu, a leader of the father's house among the Simeonites. And the name of the Midianite woman who was killed was Cozbi, the daughter of Zur. He was the head of a people of a father's house in Midian." Again, details that would not be necessary if this were some fabricated fairy tale. "Then the Eternal spoke to Moses, saying, 'Harass the Midianites and attack them, for they harassed you with their schemes by which they seduced you in the matter of Peor and in the matter of Cozbi, the daughter of the leader of Midian, their sister, who was killed in the day of the plague because of Peor.'" So here's a bit of information that's important for us to recognize in what Balaam did after giving the fourth blessing to Israel, repeating the blessing of God upon the people of Israel. It says that the Midianites harassed you with their schemes. They planned this. They wanted this to happen. Why and how? Well, it's understood, if you go back to Revelation now, Revelation in chapter 2, it's understood that the behavior causing a curse upon the people of Israel was the result of Balaam telling Balak to bring women around the people of Israel, to invite them to the feasts of their false gods. Now consider what Christ said in this regard in his third letter to the church in Revelation chapter 2. You know, before we read it, just for a moment, Jude, we had read it already, he said that there were people who believe in God, that there were people who were not entirely wicked, but it's wicked enough among the brethren there who had run greedily in the error of Balaam for profit. The Apostle Peter said something similar about a similar time in church history. In 2 Peter 2, verse 15, he said that they have forsaken the right way and have gone astray, following the way of Balaam, the son of Beor, who loved the wages of unrighteousness. He wanted to benefit from something that was not righteous. And so with this in mind, to the third era of the Church of God, Christ said this in Revelation 2 and verse 12, to the angel of the church in Pergamos, write, "These things says he who has the sharp two-edged sword. I know your works and where you dwell, where Satan's throne is, and you hold fast to my name." So this was a location where abhorrent worship of Baal was taking place. That's why it's referred to Satan's throne. And it could be there could be another meaning, but I don't want to digress too much. "You hold fast to my name, and you did not deny my faith, even in the days in which Antipas, my faithful martyr, was killed among you where Satan dwells." And he goes on to say, "But I have a few things against you." In other words, these are issues that you face or are going to face when it comes to church eras. "Because you have there those who hold the doctrine of Balaam, who taught Balak to put a stumbling block before the children of Israel to eat things sacrificed to idols and to commit sexual immorality." And so we see this is what Balaam did. He said, you know, I can't boldly, openly curse Israel. God said, you're not going to do that. I'm blessing them. He said, okay, I'm going to repeat what you say, God. But he did something else. If he couldn't openly proclaim a curse, he was going to try to bring a curse upon the people of Israel. And this was a warning to the church in Pergamum at that time. And it's also a warning to the third era of the Church of God. But it was also a warning to the third era of the church in the wilderness, that is, the church that came out of the wilderness, the people of Israel, when they were established as a kingdom in the land of Canaan, the promised land. And so it was that during those times, many people fell to the same sort of compromise that is referred to as the doctrine of Balaam or the teaching of Balaam. So Balaam appeared to have heeded God's command after making several inquiries to God about being able to curse Israel. But eventually, his self-serving attitude got the best or the worst of Balaam, and he compromised. He was unable to curse them, but he planned to provoke the people of Israel to worship false gods, to fornicate with Moabite and Midianite women, and to marry some of them. So they in turn condoned this idolatry that the people of Moab and Midian had participated in. And they associated with ungodly worship of false gods. And they were polluted. The people of Israel became tainted or polluted in this way. And this resulted in, as it's shown in Numbers 25, a curse being brought upon Israel. Now, the reflection in the third era of the Old Testament church is shown when there was a unification of Israel, that under King David, the tribes were unified and they became very strong. And then under his son Solomon, the people of Israel had experienced affluence that they had never seen before and have yet to see again. They were extremely well respected because the kingdom was established on solid ground. That Saul, David first, and then his son Solomon were very faithful to God, but not for an extended period of time. We know what happened. Solomon continued to be faithful for a number of years, but the nation eventually began to decline. Eventually, it fell into the same kind of doctrine of Balaam. You see, intermarriage with unbelievers allowed for Solomon to first condone the worship of some of the false gods that his wives, the practice of the lands that they came from. But then, in some ways, it was even promoted among the people of Israel. And this was a driving force to the degradation of Israel, to the point where the kingdom became divided, became known as the House of Judah and the House of Israel, the southern and northern kingdoms. And so the monarchy deteriorated, and there is a reflection of this in the corresponding New Testament era of the Church of God. And this actually began with an age of fortification, an age of expansion during the years 405 to 1050 AD. True Christians at that time were known as Pauletians, and this is explained in more detail in our book, Evidence for Eras. But they were known as Pauletians. They had a degree of safety, and then they had a degree of growth. But the heretical Roman Church became more and more powerful. They became more and more invasive. They threatened many of the people, the true Christians, the people of God. And they were forced to make a choice. Again, what are you going to do? It's the two trees. You can either choose to go God's way no matter what happens, or you can go along with certain aspects of the false doctrine being promoted by the Roman Church at that time. And so what happened is many people found that they could stay where they were. They wouldn't have to leave their area. They wouldn't have to migrate somewhere, but they could stay in their location, and they would be safe and avoid persecution if they conformed to some of the Catholic practices. And that happened. What we see is that it was a fulfillment of Christ's words that they would eat things sacrificed to idols, that they would commit sexual immorality, but spiritually. It's a spiritual form of fornication by allowing the practices that were done in honor of false gods. That many of those were adopted by the Roman Church, which became the Roman Catholic Church. And it's, of course, we're aware that idolatry is very much like the word adultery. They even sound similar. So the era of Balaam has more than one aspect of delusion we see. It began with going against what God had desired and attempting to find a way to bypass God's blessing and to bring a curse for profit. Balaam wanted wealth, status, prestige, honor. He was greedy in this way. And the error we see was not a mistake. It was intentional. So God gave Balaam opportunities to change his heart, but Balaam continued to evade. He continued by presenting offerings on three different occasions, hoping to get a different response from the God of Israel. And at this point, I think it's interesting for us to consider the number of times that the angel of the Eternal appeared to Balaam's donkey and tried to move it in a different direction. Does anybody remember how many times that was? Three. It was three times, actually, before the angel appeared to Balaam. But could this represent, therefore, the three times that God went to God after presenting, Balaam went to God after presenting offerings and trying to get a different response? He's saying, I want to go this way, God. And God's saying, nope, you need to go this way. But I want to go this way. Nope, you need to go this way. But I want to go this way. Nope, you need to go this way. It happened with the donkey. It happened with him inquiring of God there with the king of Moab. And so God continued to give him the same message over and over, even though he wanted to hear something else. He continued to say, nope, you need to go this way, even though he wanted to go another way. And finally, the fourth event in regards to the donkey was when the angel appeared to Balaam personally, let Balaam see him, and he spoke to Balaam. And the donkey, we saw the response from the donkey was he was wondering, why are you treating me like this? What? After the faithful service that I've given to you since I've known you, since we've been acquainted, why are you treating me this way? I'm just trying to help you, to help your situation. But could this also represent the fact that God did not deserve to be pushed against? Look, Balaam, I'm trying to help you. This is not going to go well for you if you go that way. But you keep pushing against me. But look, it's not going to go well for you. But you keep pushing against me over and over again. And so the fourth encounter could represent, therefore, Balaam's fourth prophecy, clearly stating that God's mind is not going to change about this. You know, Balaam, you can do what you want. But I'm telling you what you should do. And I'm not going to change. And what happened is Balaam actually went off and then did something that he knew was contrary to what God would have him do, but he did it anyway. And so there is a lesson for us in this that, you know, we experience something similar sometimes. Could we be experiencing something similar right now? You know, could God be trying to lead us in one direction, but we're saying, no, I want to go this way. But I want you to go this way, Terry. No, I want to go this way. But Terry, you need to go this way. But no, I want to go this way. You know, how much do we fight against, or I should say kick against the pricks or the goads? Three times? Four times? I mean, those are not lucky numbers when it comes to Balaam. It didn't work out well for him. The next delusion comes from the fact that Balaam decided to bypass God's blessing. He couldn't straight out curse Israel, but he thought, I could cause them to receive a curse from God himself if they sin. And so he devised a plan to tempt them with evil. But the evil plan, of course, does not excuse the behavior of the people of Israel. They can't say, hey, no, but Balaam and Balak, they did this. Yeah, but you have a choice. So we can't excuse our situation either. We have a choice. Which way are we going to go? Which tree are we going to take from? So the evil plan resulted in many losing their lives. Thousands lost their lives, including Balaam. So think about it. Do we ever try to bypass what God wants for us to do? Do we keep hearing him say, here's what you need to do? But then we go, I don't really want to do that. I'm telling you, this is what you need to do. I don't really want to do that. Okay, Mark chapter 8 to conclude. It's clear God is trying to teach us lessons, whether through our Bible study, through sermons, through situations that we face, that he wants us to learn what we need to do today for the future. But if we continue to move away from what God wants us to do, you know, we might have to face even more difficult times. It's going to be even harder, and we might suffer a great deal down the road. The book of Jude, where we started, says that they have gone in the way of Cain, they have run greedily in the error of Balaam for profit. Now, the term error, I had already explained, it doesn't mean a mistake like we might define it to mean today. It means that this was intentional. He devised a plan. He had something else in his mind. And in fact, it's interesting that the Greek word that is interpreted as error is pronounced plan A. What's that sound like? Plan A. Plan A. And it actually indicates a plan to stray from orthodoxy. Now, to us, it might appear to be, this is plan A, this is what I want to do. But is it really the best plan? Or could it be plan E or plan F, the plan that's going to lead ultimately to failure? Mark 8 in verse 36 says, "For what will it profit a man if he gains the whole world and yet loses his own soul?" It's talking about your life. It's talking about the opportunity for eternal life. If you lose that, what does it benefit? Even if you're given all the king's gold and silver, what's it worth if you lose your own life? What will a man give for his life? You know, plan A should always be to do God's will. You know, we have a lot of things that we are able to experience in this world. And it's very tempting at times, but what's the point? What's the point of all of it if it's just fleeting moments of pleasure or satisfaction? What's the point if there's nothing else after this? What are we going to say? Oh, well, we sure had a good time. Boy, that was great. Okay, bye-bye. That's it. Game over. Job 27 in verse 8, and I think it's something that was probably paraphrased by Christ in Mark 8:36. Job 27 in verse 8 says, "What is the hope of the hypocrite? That he may gain much if God takes away his life." There's no hope if there's no life. Vanity of vanities, says the preacher. So we should learn from this error of Balaam and not make the same kind of mistake. We see that it was an intentional mistake. It wasn't an error. Don't kick against the goads. You know, when God is trying to move us in one direction, it's best to listen. It's best to go that way, because straight is the way, narrow is the gate, or vice versa, narrow is the gate, straight is the way, that leads to eternal life. And that's where we should be going.